Topic number 3. My friends, it's now been 5 years since my nonfiction book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar, was published. The book led to appearances on countless talk shows all over America, followed by cassette tapes, and beginning 3 years ago next month, my audio letter monthly cassette series. All of this has come as an unexpected interruption in my own professional career as a financial and legal consultant with clients worldwide, and I think it's time to take stock to evaluate what, if anything, has been accomplished, and to tell you what I have learned from these 5 years of effort. But before I do that, let me say that for nearly 5 years, from 1968 to 1973, I had been helping in the development of private international business in the Republic of Zaire in Africa, and had many projects in the works there. For me, Zaire will always be a very special place, for it was there in the bush of Africa that I came to know, to love, and to walk with our Lord Jesus Christ in a way that I cannot describe. It has to be experienced. And from this experience, a spiritual experience, if I may say, I was forced to take time out. Over the years, I had been learning more and more about the real causes behind the political, economic, social, and military developments of our time. My contacts at high levels of business and government had involved many dealings also with the international intelligence community, which today serves big international business as much or more than it does government or you and me. Putting it all together, I had learned that a handful of incredibly powerful men were bent on wrecking your future for their own private gain. And so I wrote the book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar. I felt you had a right to know. And it's now 5 years since I last saw Zaire. I'm still looking forward to the day when I'll be able to return once again. But today, Zaire is under attack by the very forces I've been trying to expose and combat here in America. Zaire, like the United States and ultimately the entire world, is caught in the middle, ensnared in the power struggle between the rising empire of Soviet Russia and the crumbling empire of the Rockefeller cartel. The Conspiracy Against the Dollar became a bestseller, and I found myself on local radio talk shows all around the United States as well as in Canada. Many of the facts, dates, names, events, and plans I revealed in that book were common knowledge in the corridors of real power in America and abroad. But to most members of the public at large, these things were completely new. There appeared to be a thirst for this new knowledge about the true reasons behind the strange, tortured behavior of our world today. Gradually, I began to acquire more and more new sources of information in business, in government, and in intelligence, both here and abroad. There have been many whose alleged tips I have had to discard, since cross-checking has proven them to be inaccurate or even, in some cases, deliberately fraudulent. But there have been many others whose information has proven reliable and who have increasingly made me their exclusive channel to you. Time and again, I've been told of specific instances, which I have checked and found to be true, in which certain of my sources have given crucial information to certain well-known commentators and organizations, only to be betrayed in various ways. So in one sense, it's a great honor, privilege, and heavy responsibility for the Dr. Beter audio letter to serve increasingly as a source of exclusive information to you. But in a broader sense, it's a sad indictment of the many other public information channels who are now denied access to this crucial information. Is the so-called almighty dollar, which is collapsing, really what's important? Will no one who claims to serve the public really do it? In short, is there no honor left in America? As I'll explain in a few moments, my friends, These are not just rhetorical questions. They go to the very heart of our desperate condition today. Beginning nearly 2 years ago in the summer of 1976, exclusive information in my audio letter cassettes began mushrooming. The reason for this was the role played by the audio letter in the Soviet underwater missile crisis of 1976, a crisis which still has never been made public by the United States government nor by any major media commentator. Those of you who are long-time listeners to my audio letter broadcasts already know the story of the Soviet underwater missile crisis all too well. You were living through it while most of your neighbors slept on, unaware or not caring that we were teetering on the edge of nuclear war. But for my newer listeners especially, I believe a brief review is in order. This crisis with its aftermath was a major turning point for the audio letter and for the United States. On July 19, 1976, I recorded audio letter number 14. For months I had been relaying to my listeners the growing fears of key trustees of the Rockefeller-controlled major foundations that a double-cross of America's secret rulers by its allies, the Soviet Russia, was imminent. Those fears were not shared then by our secret rulers, but as I revealed in audio letter 14, the Russian double-cross was already underway. Soviet Russia was at that time preparing for a surprise nuclear attack. Like the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, the Russian attack plan in the summer of 1976 was based on naval strategy. The purpose of the surprise attack that was in preparation was to be the utter destruction of the United States Navy, aside from vessels at sea at the time of the attack. And the key weapons in the impending Russian surprise attack were to be not ICBMs or bombers, but short-range missiles with multiple nuclear warheads, planted in underwater launch sites in our own territorial waters. They were being planted so close to their targets as to provide zero warning time when launched. If an attack like this were carried out, my friends, there would be no doubt about the outcome of the ensuing war, especially in view of the overwhelming Russian advantage in civil defense. The United States would ultimately lose. And so in July 1976, I made public information I had received from my intelligence sources about the underwater missiles which were then being planted by the Soviet Navy. Only 2 weeks later, on August 2, 1976, I followed up with the audio letter number 15. In that broadcast, I explained the naval strategy that was involved and gave the navigational coordinates of 64 Soviet underwater missiles, which by then had been planted worldwide. This was necessary because this crucial information was being blocked from reaching the Joint Chiefs of Staff by agents within our own government, and only by making it a public issue was there any hope that action would be taken. By mid-August, Canada and Great Britain became the first nations to take action to have the missiles around them removed, and by late August 1976, the United States Navy was fast at work too, pulling up Soviet missiles in our own waters. General George S. Brown, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had succeeded in urging then-President Gerald Ford to overrule Henry Kissinger and give the order for the missiles to be removed. The removal operation was completed on August 31, 1976. The very next day, a letter was sent out over General Brown's signature to me and to thousands nationwide who had pressed the Pentagon for action. The letter said, in the present tense, that in effect no Russian missiles were in our waters. Many people wrongly concluded from this that there had been nothing to my charges about underwater Soviet missiles in our coastal waters. But a week later, I alerted General Brown that I had begun receiving coordinates for a second round of missiles, which the Russians had just begun planting. I requested a meeting with him in person to relay these coordinates, and my request was granted without delay. The meeting was arranged for 3 p.m. September 16, 1976, in General Brown's office at the Pentagon. By that date, I was able to give him 48 new locations around North America, recorded on a cassette tape for his ears only. When my associate who accompanied me to the meeting handed the special tape to General Brown, the General inspected it briefly, then put it into the inside jacket pocket of his own Air Force uniform, refusing to turn it over to anyone else at that moment. And a few days later, I received word that the United States Navy was again hard at work, pulling up Soviet missiles without a word to the public. The Pentagon has publicly confirmed in newspapers such as the Norfolk, Virginia Ledger-Star of September 27, 1976, and the Chicago Tribune of December 4, 1977, that my meeting with General Brown for over an hour did take place, exactly as I have told you. And in AUDIO LETTER 16 for September 1976, I told my listeners many more details of those tense days on the edge of nuclear war. I also alerted my listeners that General Brown would need overwhelming public support in order to continue to do his constitutional duty to the American people. As I said then, General Brown was confronted by powerful forces within the United States government who were bent on stopping him. And sure enough, on October 17, 1976, just a month and a day after my meeting with General Brown, a vicious major media blitz was launched against him. As I revealed in AUDIO LETTER 17, a fateful reversal in America's fortunes had taken place on October 1, thanks to squalid blackmail threats and intimidation of then-President Gerald Ford. Now, beginning in mid-October, General Brown found himself standing alone. Many of those who had peppered the Pentagon with demands for action 2 months earlier were somehow just a little too busy to follow up with the praise and support when it was critically needed. General Brown had gambled everything on the American people, and he had lost. In AUDIO LETTER 23 over a year ago, I revealed just how much General Brown had lost. I also warned of the possibility of personal harm to General Brown, and for months now we have seen no more of General Brown in public, as if he had been liquidated in the Russian KGB style. He has long since been replaced, to all intents and purposes, by General David Jones, a man whose similarity to General Brown begins and ends with his own Air Force uniform. General Jones has far more in common with Jimmy Carter, who broke with all tradition in order to make Jones the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Jimmy Carter wanted his own kind of man, a yes man, and now he has one. Another turning point for our nation took place a year ago. At that time, the Soviet program of nuclear sabotage in the United States in preparation for war began mushrooming. As you know, I suspended the AUDIO LETTER for a period of 3 months, late May to late August 1977, in hopes of assisting in efforts nationwide to expose and stop the fast-growing sabotage campaign. But when I resumed the AUDIO LETTER with Issue 25 in August, I was forced to tell you of the failure of this effort, thanks primarily to official inaction at all levels, including disbelief and unwillingness to investigate. Since that time, we have seen more and more of the emerging tip of the iceberg of the unprecedented threat we face. The Russian sabotage campaign that began last spring with major dams and reservoirs has long since spread to other kinds of targets, such as bridges, major public buildings, grain elevators, refineries, and for several months now, railroads, especially tank cars. But having allowed our country to fall into this desperate condition, the Federal Government is making no attempt to correct the sabotage itself. Instead, throughout the United States, Intensive training programs are now secretly underway for state police and selected local law enforcement agencies to cope with a virtual breakdown of society that could be brought about by massive sabotage. It has now become a part of Operation Garden Plot, about which I first alerted my listeners nearly 3 years ago in AUDIO LETTER II. Many other parts of the iceberg of imminent danger are also visible now besides sabotage. For example, there were the unprecedented airquakes or mystery air blasts last December through February along the East Coast and elsewhere. They were produced by Russian Cosmospheres, as I've detailed in previous broadcasts. But, my friends, regardless of the issue, whether political, economic, or involving our very life and death, the reactions of the American people as a whole to the information I made public are quite different from what I would have expected when I began 5 years ago. To me, it can only be described as abnormal and suicidal. Having been made the sovereigns over the United States of America by our Constitution, we the people have forfeited that sovereignty. All we can say is, what can we do? When confronted with massive documentation of fraud by the United States Treasury concerning our gold supplies, we do not as a people respond normally or logically. Instead of forcing our alleged public servants to prove their faithful stewardship, which would be a simple matter if no fraud existed, we simply believe their self-serving lies because they speak with authority. Then we go blissfully on our way, wondering why our economy is continuing to fall apart. When confronted with the evidence of our own eyes that something is terribly wrong with our true national security, we do not demand, much less force, our so-called public servants to do anything about it. Instead, we listen to pleasant words that acts of terrorism like those overseas are not a worry here in the United States. Thus reassured, we just scratch our heads as if we had not a clue to the cause when we see grain elevators, railroad tank cars, or other targets exploding in rashes without any precedent. My friends, we the people of the United States of America have defaulted on the most glorious chance that any people in the world ever had. And the time has now come for me to confess to you that my efforts up to now appear to have failed in their original purpose. That purpose was to help enable the American people to save our beloved Republic by making public the information that could have been used to put our secret rulers in the docket and to set our government on an honest course once again. My hope was that the final collapse of the United States, together with the deaths of millions, could be and would be prevented. My hope was that, for once, an entire people would be able to raise their eyes from the manufactured distractions of the day and to look ahead, to see disaster coming, and to take actions to prevent it. That is what I had hoped would happen. But as it stands now, my friends, there's no way disaster can be prevented except by divine intervention. To those who have no faith in God, these are the words of total defeat. And total defeat is what lies in store for our secret rulers. But what of the rest of us? I'm always asked, what can I do to save my country? For those who want my answer to this question, I have to say in all honesty, you cannot save anyone or anything until and unless your own soul is saved. And that can happen only if you accept our Lord Jesus the Christ in your heart, in your mind, and in your soul. There is no other way except by Jesus' power. Only then will you be able to point yourself in the right direction. Only then will you begin to understand what needs doing. And only then will you realize that your Creator comes first, not country, not self, not anybody, but your Creator. then will you begin to do what is right, simply because it is right. In months ahead, God willing, I hope to continue to keep you informed of events and their significance to you, just as I have been doing. But I also will try, God willing, to tell you more about what could be done to replace the evil system that is now collapsing around our ears. The republic which was created by our founding fathers is no more, except for a crumbling shell. But if we, like our founding fathers, will commit our way into the Lord's hands, we might yet have an opportunity even greater than theirs. On the ashes of a republic that stood for 200 years, there might still be built one that would last until the end, destined by our Lord. For we have not only the eternal principles that guided our founding fathers, but also the lessons of what went wrong with what they created. 1 year ago, in AUDIO LETTER 24, I used the historical precedent of the fall of Babylon to illustrate the total and imminent collapse of the United States. But we can and must pray that instead another historical precedent of long ago will take its place, that of ancient Nineveh. We are told that Nineveh, like Babylon, fell into evil practices of all kinds, and that both the leaders and the people forgot all about God. Then one day a man named Jonah began walking through the streets of Nineveh, calling to mind all the evil that was rampant in the city from top to bottom. And he warned that for turning away from God, the city would shortly be utterly destroyed. His words struck home, and both the people and the rulers of Nineveh turned aside from their ways and turned back to God. And Nineveh revived, becoming a great city once again for generations. We now face a trial by fire, my friends, and if at some point we as a people wake up and turn back to our Lord, then and only then might the remnant of our once great nation be spared. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless and protect each and every one of you.